I get really excited about what's coming down the line for Bitcoin. Like we kind of talked about, there's these other chains that move so much faster, both from speed of transactions and the utility they've unlocked. And Bitcoin has just always been flagged as a slower blockchain, but I don't know if that speed is necessarily slow or just moves intentionally.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the FCAT Crypto Brief. I'm Jason Ward, one of your co-hosts. Today, I'm here with Matt Allen and David Shapiro and a special guest from the FCAT blockchain mining team, particularly Bitcoin mining, Jack Blatchford. So I want to welcome you back. Today's topic is going to be a discussion of the Bitcoin Renaissance and what's really going on with Bitcoin Script, how the network has been evolving, and really, quite frankly, what got us here. So we're going to talk about where we may go from here. But before we do that, David, I'd love to invite you to share some of the most recent news with us.
Yeah, sure. So in the past 2 weeks, we've had a number of big stories. And the first one we'll talk about is Google has announced that they're going to launch their own L1. So the name of this chain will be called Google Cloud Universal Ledger, or GCUL. And their biggest focus is going to be on compliance. They've described this as a neutral infrastructure layer. However, the plan is for this to be a private and permissioned chain. So there's a lot of questions on, can this actually be neutral infrastructure? If it's private and permission, does that mean it's actually an L1? There's a lot of argument over sort of the semantics of this, with many calling it a DLT. So in the past, there have been a long list of failed attempts at launching private and permissioned chains. It'll be interesting to see how this goes for Google. An important factor here is that Google Cloud has massive distribution and market power. So that may be enough to make this attempt more successful than others in the past.
Yeah, Dave, I would just share, you know, a lot of people who've been in the space for a while are very familiar with how some people view public versus permissioned in somewhat very stark black and white terms. But in some cases, we see that networks could inherit security from each other, so there might be integrations. But I've also grown to believe over time that I think there can be a place for both types of ledgers. So who knows? Maybe this is this is a step in a direction addressing needs they might hear from current customers, or it could be that this is just part of their strategy. But pretty interesting one. You know, they definitely do have a lot of scale, you know, being in one of the hyperscaler main players. So we'll have to watch that one. Thanks for sharing that one. What else is going on?
So the next story is Bullish Exchange and their IPO and their decision to receive 1.5 billion of their proceeds in stablecoins. So for people who aren't familiar, Bullish is owned by a company called Block One. And Block One is one of the largest holders of BTC out there. They hold around 160,000 Bitcoins, which makes them second really only to MicroStrategy when it comes to private or public holders of BTC. If you look at like Bitcoin treasury companies, I believe Marathon is the second biggest behind MicroStrategy, and they are at around 50 to 60,000 Bitcoins. So Block One has almost three times that amount. So it's really important to understand how much Bitcoin this company actually has. So where did they get all of those funds from? It actually mostly came from the EOS ICO back in 2017, 2018. It's still the biggest ICO to have ever happened. They raised about $4 billion and promptly converted most of that into Bitcoin. And so back in 2017, 2018, $4 billion worth of Bitcoin is a huge amount. And so that's where their war chest pretty much came from. So Block One has launched a number of projects over the years. Some people may remember Voice.com. It was their attempt at launching a blockchain social media app. They spent about $150 million on this, famously buying Voice.com domain for $30 million. And that project is no longer under development. Also important to note that they aren't funding EOS development anymore. So while they raised a bunch for the EOS ICO to build out that network, they are no longer involved with it. They have a gaming studio called Mythical Games, which appears to be going pretty well. And then Bullish, the exchange in this story, is sort of an institutional focused exchange, and their IPO was very well received. It was 20 times oversubscribed.
Wow, that's great. Seems like this has been a strong market for companies that are launching IPOs, albeit, you know, we can't look at them all as one cohort, but it seems, generally speaking, it's been an active IPO season.
Yeah, definitely. So the next story is Wyoming launched their stable token called Frontier. So Frontier is the first state-issued stable token. We'll get more into that. It was announced at the Wyoming Blockchain Symposium just before the Jackson Hole Economic Policy Summit, and it was launched under Wyoming's Stable Token Act. So you may notice that they're referring to this as a stable token and not a stable coin. And the reason for that is because we've sort of landed in a place where assets launched under the Genius Act are being referred to as stable coins. But since Wyoming has their own legislation for launching stable tokens, it's called Wyoming Stable Token Act, they're referring to this as a stable token, not a stable coin. But they do closely resemble each other. They launched it on 7 chains. So Ethereum, Solana, Avalanche, Polygon, Arbitrum, Optimism, and Base. And interestingly, proceeds from this program are going to fund Wyoming's public education. So Jason, I'm curious what you think about this. Do you think that it's more of a symbolic thing, or do you think there's going to be a bright future and we'll see a lot of usage, or what?
You know, I think it's going to be an interesting story to follow because, you know, Wyoming as a state has been a leader in trying to create property laws and legislative environment that is conducive to the digital asset businesses. You know, they had this special purpose depository institution that they had passed previously, which would allow a bank to take deposits, not make loans. And that model could facilitate entities issuing stable tokens there as well. But I think a lot of what they're doing here is sending signal that Wyoming is a place where you have some certainty. Certainly, it has a long tradition of being sort of a frontier state. So I liked the way that they've positioned it. You know, I think it's going to be a stable token that's used for payments. And I think that, as you mentioned, having it available on multiple chains should allow for people to be able to access it where they want to, if they're supporting those 7 chains. But I think it's interesting because, you know, in today's day and age, we hear a lot about federal versus state, and, you know, you've got policy and you've got legal considerations. And this is an example of Wyoming leading on a policy front and now on a technology front.
Definitely. So our last story is Lombard launching their yield-bearing Bitcoin liquid staking token on Solana. So how does this work? The yield comes from staking on the Babylon protocol, and it's supposed to allow you to earn about 1% on your BTC while maintaining custody of it yourself. Now, Babylon protocol currently pays about 32 basis points. However, the yield through this program is 1%. So Matt, I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about, you know, the discrepancy in yield there and where that extra yield might be coming from?
Yeah, certainly. So I think this is an interesting story as we start to see liquid staking launched on Bitcoin. And I think leads very nicely into the discussion that we're going to have later in this episode. But as you mentioned, Babylon offers about 32 bips for their staking yield currently. Now, the additional 68 could come from a number of sources. One, it could be a commercial agreement between Babylon and Lombard Finance. You know, Babylon's trying to bootstrap their network. They might be offering incentives to Lombard to offer a liquid staking token. Additionally, Babylon pays out in the baby token. So I haven't gone back and done the math on this, but someone could go back and look at potentially it's coming from the baby token price appreciation, or it could be coming from some sort of Lombard subsidy, or even if it's like further out in the risk curve, you know, some of these Bitcoin that are supposed to be staked with Babylon could be in some sort of DeFi pool. And that's like the highest risk, but probably lowest likelihood outcome. I think it's just worth calling out the yield discrepancy because it is a risk that you need to keep in mind. And I think that we're kind of starting to get to the point in the market where there's a lot of stuff going on under the hood, and you really got to keep track of your counterparties and what they're doing with what tokens, just as a risk management practice.
Yeah, Matt, if I can build on what you're saying, sounds like we don't know. So clearly, you know, we could speculate about it. But that last point that you made is so critical. And that is really about understanding counterparty credit risk. And if we think back to what happened a few years ago, when we saw some large hedge funds executing bad counterparty credit risk, then having knock-on effects to other protocols where lending was paying, I'll say, generous yields. But in those scenarios, in many cases, people gave up custody of their crypto or their Bitcoin in order to generate those yields. It sounds like the difference here is that this is a self-custodial offering where people are picking up some yields. So that's an evolution in the market, it seems. So we'll have to continue to watch this and see how this plays out.
Yeah, certainly.
Great. Well, David, thank you very much for running down the news. We're going to take a little bit of a pivot here and build off of the Bitcoin topic and welcome in Jack Blatchford. Jack is a member of our FCAT Bitcoin mining team, as mentioned before. Jack's doing a lot of interesting work here at Fidelity in the mining space, and really looking forward to hearing about that. And we'll talk a little bit more about some research that Matt, you and Jack have partnered on. So, you know, we're going to welcome people to consume it. It's called Bitcoin Renaissance. It's a two-part series and paper. But before we really get into that, Jack, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came into the role, and then we can start talking a little bit more around Bitcoin scripting and what's happening behind the scenes.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, everyone. Long-time listener, first-time caller here. I actually got really interested about blockchain and particularly Bitcoin through this, you know, what is a podcast now, used to be that weekly webinar and even an internal newsletter since 2018. And, you know, there was this amazing event put on in 2019 about Bitcoin mining, a summit held at Fidelity, and that really sparked my interest in it, you know, particularly around the sustainability side and how, you know, mining's that physical tether for this digital network. I got so fascinated with that and, you know, very fortunate to be able to do a lot of research into that area today on the mining team, which, I mean, it's crazy. It's 10 years now Fidelity's been mining Bitcoin.
Yeah, that is amazing. So I'm glad you called out that event. So shout out to our FCAT alumni who had helped pull that off. And just for context for listeners, we hosted a mining summit in Boston and we had over 300 people from around the globe come in and talk. And we learned about off-grid mining. We learned about different strategies and how the mining space was evolving, whether it be sources of energy, location of mining, or even the evolution of the miners themselves. So it was really, really a strongly and well-received event. But yeah, it's been a while, so we should probably pick that torch up again sometime. Jack, what's going on with Bitcoin scripting? So you're in the mining space, right? So if people aren't familiar, mining is this computational exercise that helps to secure the network. And people who are contributing to that security have the opportunity to win block rewards and then also pick up transaction fees. But, you know, there's been a lot of discussion over time, like, well, how are the transaction fees getting generated? You know, does it look different today than it did when you first started working in the space?
For mining, absolutely. You know, one of the longest conversations in mining is about, you know, what will sustain miner revenue and ultimately what secures the network, you know, years down the line when the block subsidy keeps getting cut in half, right? Today it's 3.125 Bitcoin. And every 4 years, when that gets cut in half, you're going to start seeing miners' revenue really take a hit. And so what Matt and I started talking about, and what was kind of the genesis of these papers we've written, is what's on the horizon? What's going to be driving that use case for Bitcoin when, you know, miners' subsidies, which is about 99% of miner revenue, that's the new Bitcoin issued for every block. You know, as that kind of goes away, where will transaction fees come? What's going to drive that? And one of the really cool things I'm excited to talk about you all today is it's not just the monetary transactions, right? You know, Bitcoin transactions early on were how you can lock and unlock transactions, how you can unlock, you know, past transactions, right? That Bitcoin to send to a new person. There, it's very limited today, and it's been limited intentionally for that security aspect Bitcoin prioritizes. But in the future, what you can do with your transactions could look vastly different than what it has been in the past.
So when you say it's beyond the financial transactions, there's a lot of data that goes into transactions or records that are maintained by the ledger. That was a big source of discussion, debate, and eventually divergence of the network back in 2017, right around this time, August 2017. It was a pretty big event in Bitcoin space. Can you just talk to us a little bit about SegWit and maybe touch upon what we collectively call the block size wars?
It's certainly interesting, right? That that really stemmed from at the time you were starting to see blocks fill up. And before that, you know, there was transaction fees, but they're pretty minimal. And people didn't have to wait too long to include a transaction to a block. What you started seeing around then was, you know, there are these long queues of transactions getting to the next block. And as we all know, space per Bitcoin block is limited. At the time, it was only 1 megabyte. And so the conversation started to come around, well, how do you scale Bitcoin now that more people are using it? Should you increase the block size? So that was the big blocker camp. Or can you try to make transactions lighter weight or change how they're weighted and include them into blocks? And that was kind of the small block camp, which ultimately won out. And this idea of the segregated witness or SegWit came to be where, you know, a Bitcoin block is 1 megabyte, but you can have up to 4 megabytes of this witness data added onto these blocks. So in total, it can be a 4 megabyte block. And you get a little discount for using that space, that that data there in the witness field.
That is great. I think back to it, big blocks, small blocks. I mean, there's some pretty significant campaigning that was done. But ultimately, Jack, that came about because of a soft fork. And can you talk about what a soft fork is and really how miners play a role in implementing them?
Yeah, you know, soft forks, I think, are really crucial to Bitcoin's story. The idea that it's a backwards compatible upgrade. So what you were doing before, if you're a node operator, if you're helping, you know, validate transactions on the network, if you don't upgrade to this new version, you're still able to help validate transactions on the block. And let's take SegWit for an example. If you were trying to validate a Bitcoin transaction that was a SegWit transaction, but you never made that upgrade, well, it would look a little confusing, but it's still a valid Bitcoin transaction. So you would still give it its stamp of approval. And that really changed when SegWit came around, because you were able to start adding so much more to these transactions and what these transactions could store.
So Jack, is this like me having a car where I have it basically AM, FM, but I could have like satellite radio? The radio still works, even if I don't have satellite, I can still listen to some, but not all. Is that a good analogy?
You know, I think it is. And I think a good way to also build off that analogy is it's not just, you know, the FM, AM, but it's like, if you can hear the audio, you know that there's a radio station, but maybe in the future, you're also transmitting video to that radio waves. And maybe these upgraded radios can play that image as well as the audio, right? Like what we call TV today. But that doesn't discredit the fact that if you have a radio player, you can still listen to the radio.
That was great. Thanks for playing along with that analogy. You made it sound a lot better. So SegWit happens. Now you have the ability to have witness data, but backwards compatible. Not all miners chose that path, right? So that led to a big event in Bitcoin history. And, you know, can you just comment for a minute, like, what happens if you choose that you want to do a hard fork?
So there were hard forks at the time. And you know, essentially, just a little background, a hard fork is you take an entire copy of what exists, and then you start going down a different path than what we'll call the main path, that main blockchain, right? Bitcoin is always the longest blockchain. Sometimes you have, you know, these forks where two blocks get mined at the same time. And that's not a hard fork, right? That just kind of happens naturally. So whichever chain of blocks goes faster and you get that next block first, that's what we call like the main chain of Bitcoin. And the other one is kind of orphaned and you just move away from it. At the time, though, what you're kind of referencing is like the Bitcoin Cash hard fork. And so this group of, you know, industry participants, which many of them favored going down this big block path, they tried to create a hard fork. So they took all of these rules of Bitcoin, made it the few tweaks that they thought was important for scaling Bitcoin in the future, and they created their own blockchain. So essentially Bitcoin at its core with a few tweaks. And so that hard fork was not backwards compatible. It wasn't able, you were not able to keep running the same infrastructure on that new chain. Matt, what do you think about hard forks versus soft forks?
Yeah, I think you've described it very well. And I think just the one piece that I would add is that given the block size wars and really the community damage that was done throughout that time, because there are still scars that exist from the block size wars in the community, hard forks are highly disfavored now. If you want to do any sort of Bitcoin upgrade, it has to be a soft fork. Maybe that will change in the future, but that's at least the ethos as it exists right now.
Yeah, and that's great. So I wanted to go there because you're really talking about at its core, pun intended, Bitcoin is maintained by developers, right? So this community are the ones that are ensuring that we have the clear paths for how things will evolve. So Matt, I was wondering if you could touch upon some of the developer metrics, then also maybe touch upon the fact that sometimes an implementation is realized for a specific outcome, but then there might be some serendipitous additional outcome that the network grows to adopt.
Yeah, I think that that's a great question, Jason. And I might start with the second part because we've just been talking about SegWit, right? So we have a certain part of a Bitcoin block that has a discounted data field. Well, combine that with the latest Bitcoin upgrade, which was Taproot, and you kind of mash these things together, and in a completely unexpected way, all of a sudden in 2023, we have NFTs on Bitcoin. And oh my gosh, what is going on? The community just goes absolutely wild, but so do users. And we can see it in transaction fees. You can see it in on-chain data. These ordinals, the NFTs on Bitcoin, were incredibly popular. And we believe you can really look at that beginning of 2023. It created a phase shift in the Bitcoin development community. So now I'll connect that into what we're seeing within the development community. So beginning in 2023 to March 31st, 2025, we've seen 128% increase in active developers in the broader Bitcoin ecosystem. So that includes Bitcoin Core, it includes Bitcoin sidechains, new Bitcoin L2s. But that's all to say, a massive increase in developers coming to the Bitcoin ecosystem to build new products, to build new use cases. We've seen a 274% increase from January 1st, 2023 to the end of March 2025 in the amount of commits on public repos within Bitcoin-related projects. So that's why we're talking about the Bitcoin Renaissance, because we've seen this phase shift. We've never seen this before. This is completely unprecedented, this level of increase in Bitcoin development activity. And ultimately, what we're trying to research is what is going to come of that? Because the answer is still unknown, but there are a lot of different paths that you can follow to kind of get to the bottom of what may be coming down the road.
That is great. So I think about ordinals, NFTs on Bitcoin. Some would call that sacrilegious. Others would call that, very, very interesting new set of activities. And from a miner perspective, miners, they're transactions. You know, whatever they are, they're UTXOs or unspent transaction outputs, and they get added to this history of the chain. So it's really fascinating, but you know, we also see this growth of scaling of Bitcoin, right? So Jack, you mentioned Bitcoin is intentionally maintained at a in a specific way. So for those who may be new to the environment, it's basically an average of 10-minute block times for transactions to be added to the ledger. You contrast that with some of these chains that are adding blocks in microseconds. So velocity is very different. You know, we have this trilemma, you know, scalability, security, et cetera. What I think about is, how do I know that I'm actually achieving the outcome that I want? And with a limited scripting language, how can we actually do things that are equivalent loosely to like smart contracts? So I'm thinking of things like Bitcoin covenants. Jack and Matt, I'd welcome you both to maybe Jack, start with you. Can you talk to us a little bit about Bitcoin covenants?
Yeah. I think the story of like Bitcoin covenants and what future transactions looks like, taking that step back, right? When you put yourself in the shoes of an early developer of Bitcoin, your goal was to make peer-to-peer electronic cash. And so you wanted to focus on how to make that as safe, as secure as possible, how you can make that permissionless and decentralized. And so that's why the scripting language, Bitcoin is so limited today, because that was the initial goal. Now, as time has gone on, as more developers enter the space, and honestly, as you see more development in other blockchains and how they have come up with creative solutions to, you know, smart contracts and other applications there, you start to want to pull some of that value where it's been tested into Bitcoin. And so with covenants, particularly for Bitcoin, it unlocks a lot of use cases, right? It essentially enables conditions on how you spend your Bitcoin. And so today, the only conditions that you're able to really put on a Bitcoin transaction is who can spend it, right? You send it to a public address, a public key is required to unlock that. And so in order to spend that transaction, you need the private key, right? Ideally, you're the only one who has your own private key. And then there's also abilities to like delay when that transaction can be sent with time locks, but there's very few restrictions you can add on to a transaction after that. With covenants, you're now able to have a if this, then that type of control on the outputs of future transactions. You're able to say whitelist certain addresses that, you know, if I send a transaction to Matt and I say, hey, Matt, I'm adding a covenant to this transaction, a part of this transaction, maybe, you know, 0.1 Bitcoin, one of those UTXOs within it, it can only go to these three addresses. It only can go to David or to Jason, right? It can't be sent to an exchange. It can't be sent here or there. And these abilities, these changes that Covenant brings about, enables so much more utility for what your Bitcoin can ultimately do.
That is great. So as I was saying, thinking about the trilemma and having a brain fog moment, the decentralization is the key aspect here. So if I'm understanding correctly, with a covenant, you know, I can do more things, but one of those things might be that I could protect myself from error if I write a script that says I can only move Bitcoin amongst known addresses. And it might be they're my addresses, or it might be family addresses, or it might be I'm a business and I have an intention to move Bitcoin from one account to another within that business. I can put limitations on that, so I don't necessarily incur what we colloquially call the black hole problem. Is that right?
Absolutely. The idea of a Bitcoin vault is one of the low-hanging fruits and, you know, easy to describe use cases of what covenants and the underlying opcodes that are required to enable covenants could unlock.
That is fantastic. You know, as we continue to think about the future, you know, having new capabilities while still maintaining the high degree of security that has existed and we expect will exist, even as we think about things like quantum computing, we know there are people out there researching and thinking about how to adjust to the changing technological environment. There is a lot we don't know, so we can't say exactly what will happen. But I'm curious for all of you to get your take. Jack, Matt, David, how do you guys think about the future? Like, what might be next? What could we expect in the Bitcoin space? Jack, maybe you can kick it off. We'll throw it to Matt. And then David, if they've got any thoughts, please chime in.
Yeah, you know, I get really excited about what's coming down the line for Bitcoin. You know, like we kind of talked about, there's these other chains that move so much faster, both from speed of transactions and the utility they've unlocked, right? You know, being able to be turned complete. And Bitcoin has just always been flagged as a slower blockchain. But I don't know if that speed is necessarily slow or just moves intentionally. And so with all of these, you know, exciting use cases you can hear about going on Solana and Ethereum, some of those capabilities could be bridged over to Bitcoin, but in particular, how they bridge over, I don't think it has to happen on the Bitcoin layer one. And so a large part of what we wrote about was how these things can develop on layer twos and tether themselves to the Bitcoin layer one. I mean, I think BitVM is a prime example of that, right, Matt?
Yeah, I think that that is one of the most exciting developments. And I will just kind of tease it here, but BitVM started as a NAND gate on Bitcoin, so a not and, and then use that to construct every possible logical operator on Bitcoin, because that doesn't exist in Bitcoin script. We've then gone from NAND gate to building a BitVM optimistic rollup to now developing BitVM ZK rollups, all in the span of 2 years. So that's all to say, I think between the momentum behind a soft fork upgrade for Covenants, as well as the momentum behind some of these new and novel bridging techniques on Bitcoin, we're going to see new use cases and new abilities to use your Bitcoin in novel ways. When that is unclear. What they will exactly look like is unclear. But what is actually very clear and very exciting is the level of development activity and research that's going on behind the Bitcoin protocol. And that's what we really wanted to focus on in the paper. And I would just suggest everyone go skim the paper, go read the paper. You'll learn a lot, we hope. It is a very in-depth paper.
Right. And one of the cool things, I think, to kind of sum this all up, is that, you know, Vitalik Buterin was an early developer on Bitcoin, but he got very frustrated because there was so much limitations with what you could do. And he had visions of, you know, the decentralized ecosystems built on top of Ethereum today. Well, that he wasn't the only developer to leave working on Bitcoin to go to other projects because of that frustration. What's exciting and what I think the trend we're really trying to hit on is that a lot of that, those developers and a lot of developers who then came up in those ecosystems are now trying to find ways to incorporate what they've built and their interests onto Bitcoin and with Bitcoin.
That's fantastic. And David, you know, you started out talking about staking, you know, Matt's talking about the virtual machine, zero knowledge proofs. Jack's talking about, adding to and talking more about capabilities in L2s. Dave, what else do you think? You know, is the staking thing going to take off, or what else might take off?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the million-dollar question here is, how are we going to pay Bitcoin's security budget in the future? And there's a lot of different ideas on how to achieve this. Some think that we should have, like, dynamic block sizing, where when there's not a lot of transactions going into the blocks, we size the blocks down to sort of artificially raise the fees on the smaller amount of transactions that can fit into them. But the story that the paper tells and the developer data that we're seeing is that there is a lot of enthusiasm around building Bitcoin L2s. And so what I'm most excited to see is Bitcoin, you know, open up these opcodes that allow it to verify whether it's optimistic rollups or ZK rollups. You know, that's the path that I'm excited to see play out and that I'm hopeful, you know, will end up coming to fruition.
That is great. And I think you're right. It's all about the security budget and how do you maintain that decentralized network that is, you know, frankly, just, you know, for lack of a better term, the granddaddy of them all, you know, to sort of build upon the Rose Bowl and the parade. But, you know, so we're wrapping up here. I want to thank everybody for listening. Before we do that, I want to make sure that you know where to find this paper. You can go to fcatalyst.com and go to the Insights and Education Overview for Blockchain. It's Bitcoin Renaissance, a technical deep dive by Matt Allen and Jack Blatchford. And then we also wanted to let people know we will actually be doing a live recording from ETH Boston on September 12th. So hope people get the opportunity to go and attend. It should be a great event.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2025 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.